Okay. Let's actually begin with one of my favorite prayers that I always like to pray before we begin classes. Let us pray to the Lord. Lord, have mercy. Illumine our hearts, O Master, who lovest mankind with the pure light of thy divine knowledge, and open the eyes of our mind to the understanding of thy gospel teachings. Implant in us also the fear of thy blessed commandments, that trampling down all carnal desires, we may enter upon a spiritual manner of living, both thinking and doing such things as are well-pleasing unto thee. For thou art the illumination of our souls and bodies, O Christ our God, and unto thee we ascribe glory, together with thine unoriginate Father, and thine all-holy and good and life-giving Spirit, now and ever and unto ages of ages. Amen. And that's the prayer that the priest prays right before the reading of the gospel and the liturgy. That's where that prayer comes from. Yeah, right. It's an ideal prayer for exactly before study, before reading. Yeah. Okay. So as we continue through the history of the church, we had stopped last time, I think somewhere in the 9th century, somewhere around there, and we're going to try to get through the rest of it this evening. But before jumping into that, I thought I would just say again a few words of sort of giving it a spiritual orientation, because it's important for us always to remember that we don't, as Orthodox Christians, we don't want to approach any of this as some kind of dry academic pursuit, right? Even, if you're studying theology in an academic setting, but you're doing it as an Orthodox Christian, you should see that as something like, not like you're engaged in academia, but you're engaged in something that has to do with the essence of your life, and it just happens to be that you're doing it in this setting, you know? So, it's important, I think, for us to keep that in mind. So we want to always be reminding ourselves of what our true purpose is as Orthodox Christians, as people in this world. Why are we here is always the question. The Desert Fathers would say that. They would repeat that question. Why have we come here? It's a good thing always to kind of ask, you know, why do we come here? So in other words, we didn't just come here to lounge around and have a good time. You know, why did the Desert Fathers go out into the desert? To wage warfare, you know, to fight against the demons, in themselves, to overcome their passions, you know, to prepare for the kingdom of heaven. So why are we here? That's always the question. You know, why are we in this world? So, and of course, you know, our Orthodox answer to that is, well, we're here, the purpose of our life is to prepare for death, which sounds kind of doom and gloom and you know, something like that, fatalistic. But it's not. Of course it's not. Because the point is that we were created for another world. We're created for the kingdom of heaven. And insofar as this world has become fallen, it's no longer our true home. It just isn't. You know, God created a paradise for us to dwell in, but we lost that. So now we find ourselves in this fallen mode of existence, which is not our true mode of existence. It's not what God created us for. So we always keep that in mind. Another thing I want to share with you before we dive back into the history of the church is something from St. Arsenius the Great, one of the Desert Fathers of the 4th century. He was known for being particularly austere, St. Arsenius. He was actually a high-ranking court official before he became a monk. You know, he was in the court of the emperor, well-known, well-regarded, wealthy. You know, he had it all in earthly terms. But he left it all, and he became one of the most austere monks of the Egyptian 4th century desert. And he was known especially for silence. People would come and visit him and ask him for a word, and he would just say, you know, if you're not edified by my silence, you won't be by my words. You know, just, I'm not going to tell you anything. There was once a princess who came to visit him, and she had known him and the world, and she had some kind of need for spiritual counsel, and she came to him and she asked him for a word. She traveled all the way out into the desert, found him, and came to his... So a lot of times he wouldn't even open the door. People would come to visit him. He'd just, I'm praying, you know, I came out here to be alone. I came out here to be quiet and to be with God, and don't interrupt my prayer, kind of thing. So this princess came, and, you know, probably it took some convincing, but they finally prevailed on him to actually open the door to her. But then she asked him for a word, and he just said, I pray that God will take the memory of you from my mind as soon as you leave here. Yeah. Right, which sounds like some kind of extreme craziness or something like that. But of course what he means is so that there's no passionate anything. She's beautiful or whatever, you know. So that was his word to her, you know, like, give your whole heart, he's saying, your whole mind, your whole heart to God, and don't give yourself over to the passions. So Christian life is, on the one hand, very easy, and on the other hand, it's very hard. Why is it easy and hard at the same time? St. Arsenius has this great expression, if we seek God, he will show himself to us, and if we keep him, he will remain close to us. If we seek God, he will show himself to us, and if we keep him, he will remain close to us. So it's very simple. He's just giving us two instructions, seek and keep. It's very simple. Christian life is simple. It's easy in that Christ is always near. He's not far. You know, the word is not far off. It's in your mouth and in your heart. It's right there. You know, Jesus Christ is Lord. He's present. And he's just waiting for us to reach out to him. And it doesn't take some kind of great academic pursuits or knowledge or anything like that. You could just be a simpleton, uneducated. Lots of the greatest saints were not very well educated. Dustin and I were talking about that yesterday. So it's not complicated to be a Christian. We just have to want Christ with our whole heart. That's it. Easy, right? But what makes it hard is that our heart is a mess. It's divided. It's divided up into a million pieces. And our mind is confused. It's pulled in a million directions. You know, we have all of these distractions, all of these things. So the mind, the nous, which is supposed to be at home in the heart, present there with Christ, is off all over the world, gallivanting around. It's going here, going there, it's thinking about this, it's thinking about that. That's what we're always dealing with. So we have these passions, what we call the passions, are always pulling us here, pulling us there. And so it makes it very hard for us just to focus, just to concentrate, just to find a little bit of peace so that we can really be with Christ, so that we can seek God and do it in a single-minded way. So for that seeking to be effective, for it to be efficacious, for it to bring about the result that we're looking for, it has to be a single-minded seeking, not a divided, not a distracted seeking. So that's the whole struggle. That's what makes it very hard. It's very simple, very easy, on the one hand. On the other hand, very hard, because of our dividedness. So we're struggling in our Christian life to become single-minded, to have a heart that's dedicated to Christ. Right now we're double-minded, and our heart's a mess, and this is what makes it hard. So our whole Christian life, our walk with Christ, our struggle, however you want to describe it, is about bringing our heart and mind into union with God's will and purpose for our life. So it's a matter of continually seeking God, as St. Arsenius says, and as the Lord says in the Gospel, seek and you will find, right? Very simple. Again, knock and the door will be open. Ask and it will be given to you. Okay, but how must you seek and knock and ask? With an undivided heart, with a pure mind. So that's the whole struggle. So we could say we want to become more simple in a good sense, more simple. Not simple in terms of being of an immature understanding of things, but simple, childlike, with a heart that's pure, that's not full of guile. It isn't always, you know, kind of stuck in these rationalizations and trying to figure everything out, but trusts God, you know? That kind of simplicity is what we're seeking. And this is what you see in the saints, even very, very highly intelligent, highly educated ones, like St. Basil the Great, St. Gregory the Theologian, who had the best education of their day. I mean, they were unbelievably well-read and articulate, eloquent. You know, if you just read their sermons that they gave, it's incredible, but very simple hearts. So that's the goal. So looking at church history, we're looking at the history of God's love for humanity, right? And we said before, it's the history of human beings that have been transformed, who begin as sinners and are transformed, being filled with God's love, becoming holy, becoming saints. It's also messy, church history. You know, you have all these heresies and heretics, and including bishops who are heretics, and people fighting each other, and the church being at odds with the civil authorities and all kinds of Byzantine intrigue, you know. There's a reason why that term was coined, Byzantine intrigue, you know, because there's a lot of that going on during the Byzantine era. But so it's messy on the one hand, because the church is full of human beings. Father Tom Hopko would say, right church, wrong people, you know, like, because there's things that are wrong with us, he means, you know. Or the problem with the church is that it's full of people, you know. If we weren't here, then everything would be smooth. But because we're a bunch of sinners, we make messes. But while church history is messy, throughout it, God's love is also always evident. How he's providentially bringing about the fulfillment of his purpose and bringing people close to him, even as human beings are doing a lot to mess up. But we see, even as we're messing up, he's bringing us closer, and we're, God willing, being transformed. We certainly see that in the case of the saints, that they are transformed, that they are the proof that it's real, that it works. And as I said before, St. Athanasius the Great says, the existence of the martyrs is the proof of the resurrection of Christ, because you can't do that without that. You can't joyfully go to your death singing hymns, being at peace, you know, all these things that the martyrs were inspired to do. If there's no grace, it doesn't work. In fact, you read in the lives of the saints, there are examples of certain people who were on their way to martyrdom, but because of some passion in them, pride in particular, they failed. They failed. At the last minute, they betrayed Christ. You know, so, and of course, you think of St. Paul and writing to the Corinthians saying, you know, though I have, you know, I can do all kinds of wonders and have tongues and this and that and all of these things, and though I give my body to be burned and yet have not love, it's nothing. It's worthless, you know? So he's like saying, even if you're a martyr but you're not doing it out of love, then it's worthless. Because it has to be love. But the reality is, you can't be a true martyr without love. That's the point. You know, you could go through some kind of motions, but what we see, in at least in certain examples in the lives of the saints, is these people who are doing it without love, with some other egotistical motive, they fail.
Americans, whether they're Christians or not, and they're hitting them online and stuff like that.
Yeah.
When they're talking about it, we're like, we hope that we wouldn't like be crying and begging, that we'd be like, just do it. But that's not, see, like I've been trying to rework my mind of what it looks like to get a response or whatever, because I don't want to be a person without courage. And so before, the courage looked like fight and, you know, be stoic and, the idea that they walked, that Russians walked Jews up a hill and they would shoot them so they wouldn't have to drag their body. And my husband and I looked at each other like, if I knew what you were doing, I mean, you'd drag me. I'm not. That's not love. So I didn't have words for it before. What's the difference between being cowardly and an Orthodox kind of courage rather than a human?
Yeah.
So I think that's
what you're
saying the difference would be.
Right. It's, yeah. Because true virtue is of Christ, true courage is courage that comes along with love for Christ and knowing his love.
The people, right? Like, so you have, who was it that was pushed off of the temple? Was it St. James?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So then, and he doesn't die, and he says, don't count this against them. Like that kind of love.
Yeah. Or like St. Stephen being stoned. He says, Lord, don't hold this against them. That's exactly right, yeah. There's no pride in that. There's no, wounded sort of sense of injustice, like, this isn't fair. No, it's just, it's got to begin with love for Christ. It's got to be, because first is love for God. But then that, when we really know Christ and we're transformed by his grace, then it becomes possible to truly love other people with sacrificial love for even our enemies. And then you can say, don't hold this against them, even as they're killing you. Which is exactly, that's perfectly Christ-like, right? That's exactly what Christ does on the cross. So we see the saint, that's Christian courage, yeah. Exactly. Say that again. Yeah. That's a tough one. I think most of us are not in a place yet where we could pull that. But if your vision is just totally heavenly, you know what I mean, and you just see. And some of the saints even had a vision at that moment where they could see it. Like St. Stephen, it says his face was shining, radiant like an angel, and he said, I behold the heavens open, He could see it, so then that gives you that courage maybe at the last minute where you need it or something, where you can actually then say, come on, kids, come on, everybody, we're going into the kingdom, They can kill our bodies, but we're entering into life, So, so let's now go back into the timeline and going through church history. So, as I said, I think last time we ended in the 9th century with talking about Pope Nicholas in 865, writing that the Pope has authority over the whole earth. Then, of course, that wasn't accepted by any of the other churches. And this is this period, the couple of centuries leading up to the Great Schism, where you have kind of back and forth. One pope will say yes, one pope will say no. They'll go back and forth on this. Then there was that Fourth Council of Constantinople, which rejected the filioque and confirmed St. Photius the Great as the Patriarch of Constantinople. Fast forward a little bit, about 50 years, and now we're getting into the 10th century, the 900s. There's still this, tension east and west, really just the Church of Rome and the other churches. But meanwhile, we mentioned last time St. Cyril and Methodius beginning to go and to evangelize the Slavs. And so that work has continued, of the evangelization of the Slavs. They've translated things into Slavonic, ancient Slavic language. Apostles, missionaries, have gone to different Slavic nations, tribes, and begun this work of spreading the gospel. But it isn't until 926 that in Bulgaria there's finally an independent patriarchate, and then in 955, a significant event for the Russians is that Princess Olga becomes a Christian. So she converts. Now, who is she? She's the grandmother of Saint Vladimir, who is considered the baptizer of Russia. So his grandmother becomes a Christian. He doesn't until a little bit later, of course. And that is in 988. That's when Saint Vladimir converts to Christianity, and the story in the Russian tradition about Saint Vladimir is that he sent emissaries, he sent messengers to different groups of people. They were, of course, pagan. They had a pagan religion, kind of an old Viking-like pagan religion. But he had heard, you know, about Christians. Of course, he knew his grandmother had converted to Christianity. He knew about Islam. He knew about the Jews. He said, well, these all, they're monotheistic. You know, this is a different, you know, kind of religion from ours.
Sounds like Lily's encouraging him to fight.
Okay. It's the arena over here in ancient Rome, right? Being taken out to the beasts or something, fighting with gladiators. So St. Vladimir sent out messengers to different groups of people in order to investigate their different religions. So there were messengers who went to a Muslim tribe. There were messengers who went to a Jewish group of people. There were some who went to, I think, Western lands, if I remember right, went to Rome or something like that. And then there were some who went to Constantinople. And they simply said, you know, the other ones, there were pros and cons, you know, they reported back and said different things. But the ones who came from Constantinople just said, they went into Hagia Sophia, the famous cathedral in Constantinople, and they said, we didn't know whether we were in heaven or on earth. The worship was just out of this world. It was just so beautiful. And so that was very convincing. And so they communicated with the church in Constantinople, and St. Vladimir was baptized, and with him, the people of Russia. Rus, at that time it was Kiev and Rus. Kiev was the capital. But they began converting to Christianity, and that became, at first, the center of the church. Christianity for the Russian people was in Kiev. Later, it transferred to Moscow, and then they became like two different churches, metropolitanates, metropolises. So then, of course, now we're getting into, now we're around the year 1000. And in the early 11th century, so like between 1009 to 1015, this time, it was when the Filioque finally became official in Rome. So it's been kind of back and forth debate. Charlemagne had said, had imposed it back around 800. So this is two centuries later, it finally becomes official in Rome. This is part of the creed. This is the way we do it. All the churches under the Church of Rome have to use the Filioque. So, of course, that exacerbated the tension between the East and the West, between the other churches in Rome, and that led up to the Great Schism in 1054.
Why did they not agree that something like that would have to be during a council? Since that's how every other thing that was doctrinal had to be through a council.
Didn't something else like come up hundreds of years prior to that, to where he was already like, "Well, I'm in charge anyway."
Yeah, that had started coming, as I said, in the 800s. Yeah. It started to develop that idea. Now, interestingly, you know, the Pope didn't become infallible until the First Vatican Council in the 1800s. But still, the popes began claiming to have authority. What did Pope Nicholas say? He has authority over the whole earth, over every church. So that was in 865, where that. Yeah. I mean, that was kind of the. No, the Roman Church continued to have councils. They say, you know, they have cardinals, they have councils, and things like that. But it's like the Pope has the final say in it. Anyway, at this time, they were having parallel councils. They were. So they don't recognize the Eastern one, which reinstated Photius. They have their own that they recognize, you know. So, yeah. So they would say it was conciliar. And if the other churches don't recognize it, that's their problem, kind of thing. But we would say what you said, you know, it's never been done like that, and you can't just impose it unilaterally. That's not the way the church works. There's no way, you know. Not to mention the fact that you just can't change the creed. You just can't at all. Even if you, like, go ahead, have a council and try to change it. You just can't change the creed, you know.
It's you're undoing the original councils.
Yeah, exactly.
You're
undermining the authority. But here's the thing. In the West, they're developed this, and really the scholastic theologians developed this, but it was already incipient, you know, it was in seed form from the time of the split. The idea of the development of doctrine, that doctrine develops, that you can actually become more illumined later on than the apostles were. You know, which from an Orthodox perspective, that's just crazy. That's crazy talk. You can't, there's no way, you know. The fullness of the truth was present from the time that the Holy Spirit came upon the apostles at Pentecost. There's no more fullness than that. Now, there were things that had to be articulated, so we do have kind of an idea that the articulation of the faith develops, but not a new revelation of the truth. No, certainly not. So, but this does come in some of the Western theological thinking, is this idea that you know, the fathers were more primitive somehow, and like we have a fuller, more sophisticated understanding. Yeah. Yep. We would say absolutely not, you know. Like we're way below where the fathers were, you know. Okay, so unfortunately, from the time of the Great Schism, there are not only problems within the church, but because the Western, the Church of Rome becomes more and more wed with politics. Yeah, exactly. So things turn violent. Things turn very ugly very quickly, and you start to have the Crusades. So at the end of the 1000s, around the year 1100, you have the first crusade, goes to Antioch and Jerusalem. Of course, ostensibly, they're going to convert Muslims, you know, but what happens is they actually end up attacking Christians as well, and the crusaders set up rival Latin patriarchs in those places where they go. So now there's a Latin patriarch in Jerusalem, a Latin patriarch in Antioch, and so on. So this is the first time ever you have rival Christian, let me scale that back a little bit. Because of the split with the Monophysites, this kind of thing already actually exists. Because, for example, in Alexandria, there are the Copts, or the, you know, the non-Chalcedonians, so they have their hierarchy, and then there's the Orthodox hierarchy. But this is still, it's something new, because these are places where, you know, this is being imposed, and it's being imposed kind of from outside. It's not the indigenous people breaking away and forming their own sect. You know what I mean? It's like, it's another church from another place coming and saying, no, we have authority here, and we're going to put our bishop there, and we're going to put our bishop there. So that's what happens. And really, before this point, it's like the split between Rome and the Orthodox Church, in a lot of ways, was just on paper. For local people, you know? It's like the average person in Jerusalem probably didn't think about it very much. Average person in Rome, you know, they weren't thinking about it. Now they started to really feel it, because now you have... They're imposing this other authority and, you know, establishing other churches, and now it's like you're starting to have denominationalism, you know. It's not just the church, now it's the church and then the Latin church, you know. So this starts to happen. Another century goes by. Well, in the meantime, there are more crusades, but let's just mention 1204, the fourth crusade attacked Constantinople. Sacked it, raped, pillaged, desecrated churches. Is there supposed to be Christian warriors going to liberate, you know, the Holy Land from the Muslims? They attack Constantinople, which is not under the control of the Muslims, you know.
Who? This is the Western Church that sent these people off?
Yeah.
What's that thought?
Yeah, the Franks.
Well,
I mean, what happened was they were heading towards Jerusalem. I can't remember what happened. There had to be a change of plans. They got diverted. They said, we've got all these guys. They're going to need to like take some loot back home. we're not able to do what we were going to do. We're going to go here instead.
So it wasn't necessarily the Pope that told him to do that?
No. But the Crusades in general were certainly with the blessing of the Pope. Yeah. As an idea. It, you know, as a as an institution, it was with the blessing of the Pope.
Is it more ideological that you say Jerusalem's being taken over by the Muslims and we need to go save Jerusalem for Christ rather than cosmological or church? I don't know, like, would Orthodoxy ever go in and tax? Like, we're not going and saving Hagia Sophia from Muslims.
Well, but that did happen throughout church history. I mean, you'd have Christian people going to the aid, sending military aid to help other Christians. Yeah, I mean, that definitely, that does exist. Oh, yeah. Georgia? Yeah, I mean, yeah. Yeah, I mean.
There's precedent for something.
Yeah, there's precedent for coming to the aid of your fellow Christians, certainly. And, I mean, you have, like, the example of when the Ottomans were pushing north through Europe. Well, the Serbs stopped them in Kosovo. And the Serbs, you know, they got slaughtered, but the Ottomans never went any further. They saved Western Europe. The Serbs, like, sacrificed themselves. Now, they weren't going on conquest. They were defending their homeland. Certainly, though, with the blessing of the church, you know, to, like, defend the innocent. Yeah, for sure. Yeah. So, now, in speaking of the Serbs, the Serbian church is next on my timeline here. 1219, an independent church of Serbia is formed under Saint Sava. Saint Sava, the first Archbishop of Serbia, he was just a godly monk, had no kind of designs on doing anything like that. But he was the son of the king. He was a prince. So certainly had been formed as a leader, as a potential leader, and God used that. So eventually the Serbian church became its own patriarchate in 1346. Meanwhile, 1237 is when the Mongols invade Kievan Rus, and they destroy Kiev. They just obliterate many of the cities, the Russian cities. And from 1237 to 1480, the Russian people are under the control of the Mongols. So it's a very long period, about 2.5 centuries. Now, thankfully, the Mongols, once they gained control and could tax the Russians, kind of subdued them, they basically let them live their lives and practice their faith and everything like that. But of course, the Russians still wanted to be liberated and, you know, have their country back. But they were able; the church was able to function during that time. There wasn't a whole lot of martyrdom other than when they were just conquesting and just slaughtering them. You know what I mean? Like, during the rest of the period, it was relatively peaceful. So, 1261, the Latin occupation of Constantinople continues until 1261. So from that time that they attacked Constantinople in 1204, for almost 60 years, they set up a Latin kingdom in Constantinople, like a little kind of mini kingdom. And that continues until 1261, when the Orthodox Greeks from other, you know, from around the Mediterranean world come and recover Constantinople. But the fact is, it never really recovers until the Ottomans come. So the Crusaders really set things up for the Eastern Roman Empire to be devastated. You know, now, might have happened anyway, but they certainly didn't help things. In 1274, under political pressure, the Byzantine emperor attempts a reunification with Rome, which ultimately fails. This is Emperor Michael Palaiologos, and basically he's trying to convince Rome to, you know, hold this council, and that, you know, the Orthodox bishops will agree to, you know, to go along with Rome, to accept the papal supremacy, to accept the filioque, to accept all of these things. And so he tries to kind of broker this deal, but ultimately fails because the church doesn't accept it. It doesn't. So it doesn't really happen. And then getting into the 14th century, the 300s, we have in the early part of the 1300s, Peter, the Metropolitan of Russia, moves the center of the Russian church from Kiev to Moscow. That's when that happens. And this coincides with the political center for the Russian people, the capital moving from Kiev to Moscow. So Moscow is growing, that ends up becoming the capital, and so the center of the Russian church moves there as well. Keep in mind, you know, why Rome and Constantinople were important cities in the life of the church is because they were big political centers with lots of Christians, and so in a sense it was very practical that those would be places where, you know, that around which other churches would kind of gravitate. What's that? It's like Rome. Exactly. That's the idea. You know, it's like for us here, you know, we have our archdiocese headquarters in the New York area. You know, it's like easy access to airports. It makes sense. You know, people will gather there as opposed to some podunk town in Louisiana or something like that. You know, where it's hard to get to or something. Now, in the middle of the 1300s, there's another theological controversy within the Orthodox Church, but there's influence coming from the Roman Catholic Church involved in this. And this is what's called the Hesychast controversy. It has to do with, one issue is simply prayer. How we pray, how prayer works, and whether hesychastic prayer is an integral part of our tradition, or whether it's just some kind of monastic practice that's a little eccentric, you know. And so there was this fellow Varlaam who was attacking the monks of Mount Athos and accusing them of basically being deluded. And he said, you know, he called them navel gazers because they would look down like this when they were praying, these navel gazers and all of this. And they think they see God, and making fun of them, you know, because they're talking about seeing the uncreated light. And so there's this kind of practical side to the prayer part of it, but it's also connected to this very theological issue, because he only recognizes in God He only recognizes in God his essence, and says that's all that's what God is. God is his essence. And this is related to the Western doctrine, although it's phrased a little bit differently, that you find, for example, in Thomas Aquinas, that God is actus purus, which is like pure act. But so there's no distinction. There's this idea of divine simplicity. God is simple. He's not compounded of parts, which our theology agrees with. But the idea is that, you know, he's because he's simple, when he acts, that's his essence. It's his pure act, you know, this kind of idea. So there's no distinction between what we would call his essence and his energy. His energy is his activity. So this is kind of the main theological issue. There's a big debate between Varlaam and then others who followed Varlaam, kind of along the same lines, and on the other hand, St. Gregory Palamas and those who are on his side. And from an Orthodox perspective, St. Gregory Palamas simply represents the Orthodox tradition. Like he's just continuing what all the fathers taught. He's not introducing anything new. But Varlaam is actually introducing something that comes from the West. Well, Varlaam he loses the debate, and he ends up going to the West and becoming a Roman Catholic bishop.
Yeah. So then he was a priest, or he was something in Orthodoxy?
He was a clergyman, not a bishop, if I remember right. I think he was a priest. He was a monk. He came from Calabria, which is an Orthodox enclave in Italy at this time. At this time, there were still Orthodox monastic communities in Calabria in Italy. And that's where he came from. But he's clearly influenced.
Is it safe to say that the Roman Church didn't know he held these different beliefs? I mean, because like you said, it was essentially on paper at the time, and I guess it was still relatively early, so I can't imagine that too much of the way it was practiced was different in the Eastern or Western Church at the time. Did they know anything about him, or did they know anything?
Oh, when they accepted him from... No, I mean, the point is, his understanding was very Roman, mm-hmm. so they easily accepted him. Yeah. I mean, by this time, things changed pretty quickly, actually. You can look at the sacred art. It's very interesting how quickly it moves from being Byzantine iconography to something more passionate, something more sentimental, and so on. It happens very quickly. By this time, for sure. Yeah, and you know, the scholastic theologians have been at work by this time and everything. So, anyway, more about that later. But for now, we'll just say there were three different councils during the 1300s that all vindicated St. Gregory Palamas that took place, like in Constantinople. The next century, we'll fast forward again about 100 years, and in 1438 to 1439, there was a second attempt at reunion with Rome in Florence, and this council again fails. Again, it's politically motivated. The Ottomans are closing in on Constantinople. The emperor is desperate to receive aid from, you know, the Westerners, and so he tries to arrange this reunion. Actually, this time, under lots of pressure, most of the bishops sign the statement of reunification. St. Mark of Ephesus does not, you know, and of course, he's the one who's a saint. He doesn't accept it, and then none of the people back home accept it either. So they were rejecting their bishops. When their bishops came back, they said, no way, you betrayed us when you went and you signed that. Because at least, you know, a lot of the pious people understood that it was a betrayal, that they had, you know, they had given up the Orthodox faith in order to receive, in order to... Yeah, for a temporary solution, exactly. So it's only 15 years after that that the Ottomans do conquer Constantinople, and that's the end of what we recognize as the Roman Empire. So eventually, after the Ottoman conquest, the center of free church activity shifts from what was the Roman Empire to Russia. And so for the next few centuries, that's where the church is able to operate freely. The Russians are now free from Mongolian control, and so they're able things are able to flourish there. We can ask a question?
I'm just trying to follow along here. I thought, I'm just trying to figure out what you're saying. Okay, so back in the 1100s during the Crusades, Constantinople was lost. It was before that, was lost. And then it was brought back later.
Yeah, they reconquered it from the Crusaders.
Yes, Rome took it over at that point?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, they set up a Latin kingdom in Constantinople for about 60 years. And then, you know, the Greek-speaking Orthodox Christians of the area were able to reconquer it. But now, once the Ottomans conquered Constantinople, they have it for centuries. Until now. Until
so the
now.
The Ottomans were Muslim.
Yeah, yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. The Turks, yeah. Yes, yeah, so now it's Turkey. Yeah. So it's until now, although now this is kind of, we'll get there. So now, 1453 is when that happens. Just a little over half a century, 60 some years later, Protestant Reformation in Europe, Western Europe. 1517 is when, you know, that's the date that's typically given for the Protestant Reformation. It's beginning with Martin Luther, John Calvin, Zwingli, these reformers. And then about a decade later, 12 years later, is when the Church of England forms, breaks away also from Rome. And so this begins a chain reaction. Now, there's a split, and then another split, and then another split, and then it continues until today when you have 30,000 denominations or whatever it is. Yes?
Where does that number come from? Me and her were talking about it. And, is it just because essentially if there is a disagreement in one church council and they open up another one, that essentially counts as another one?
Oh, yeah.
It's sort of figured because that does happen all the time.
Yeah, just splits. And they call themselves something new, you know, like, you know, so you're incorporated as the whatever church, you know, the church of whatever. So, yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
I was thinking about it, and like I can't think of a single church, Protestant church that I'm aware of that is essentially in communion with another church where they do everything the same way. Like it doesn't exist.
Yeah. I mean, you have denominations, so you have United Methodist churches and things like that, but
they don't work together.
But and they've just and of course now they're all kinds of Methodists. You know what I mean? They're not just the United Methodists. There's the Free Methodists and the this and the that. So, yeah, it's just continued until now. And there are new church organizations forming all the time. Okay, that later that same century, 1500s, there was what was called the Union of Brest, or Brest-Litovsk. This is an infamous event from an Orthodox perspective. What took place was, under political pressure, several million Orthodox Christians united with the Roman Church. Yeah. So these people became known as Uniates, because they united with the Roman Church, so they're the Uniates. But you have to understand, there you have the Austro-Hungarian Empire, and the borders are changing, and you know they were very powerful for a while, and there were lots of Orthodox Christians within their territory, and they with the participation of the Roman Catholic Church, they began putting intense pressure on the Orthodox Christians just to convert. But what they did at this union was they basically said, you can keep everything the same, you just have to commemorate the Pope. So you will be part of our church. Priests can be married. You do the divine liturgy the same. So this is where we get Byzantine Catholic. Or, you know, they have different names, but at least this is one of those origins of the Byzantine Catholics. There are other groups who are under the Roman Catholic Church who also use our liturgy and, you know, look like us. For example, in the Middle East, you have the Melkite Church. That's kind of the Middle Eastern version of Uniatism, which exists until today. So, anyway, Uniatism exists until today, but in the late 1700s, so around the time that, you know, the U.S. Constitution was being written, and beginning then, until now, thousands of Uniate churches have gone back to the Orthodox Church. Basically, once they were politically able, you know, sort of free and able to make that choice. And many of them did it in America. They immigrated as Uniates. They had their churches here. And then you have all these stories where, you know, the married Uniate priest goes to a Catholic bishop and he's just like, I'm not going to talk to you. Priests aren't supposed to be married, you know. And he said, but, you know, you said... St. Alexis Toth up in Minneapolis, I think, was where he was. He was one of those. He had this experience actually of going and talking to a Roman Catholic bishop, and he just said, just, you know, you're not a proper.
Where Where does the
priest?
Where do the Romans get the Roman Catholics get that from where you can't get married as a priest?
That developed very early on, long before the split, in the West. This idea, and they argue that, you know, that's the way it always was supposed to be, except it never was in the East. And even in the West, I don't think it was uniform until a little bit later. There are kind of practical reasons why they did that. One was that there was an abuse in the West that existed where there was church property that was being, it was treated as hereditary, it was being passed down. And they wanted to stop that. Yeah, to his sons. So the priest's son would become a priest, and then he would inherit it, and then, you know, so it was like they were keeping it in the family, and they didn't. So it was a kind of an abuse that was taking place. Okay, that's fine. But and then also, you know, we have there are canons that address the issues around clergy being married, living with their wives, and so on. But actually, what the canons say is, if a clergyman refuses to live with his wife out of some like sense of like disgust, you know, like marriage is inappropriate or something like that, let him be deposed. You know, it says in the canons, like excommunicated. You know, because it's like you're looking down on marriage. It's holy. Marriage is holy. So that's in the canons. But then also, there's a provision made for bishops to be unmarried because they're supposed to be monastics. They're, you know, tonsured monastics who then become bishops, and it's very practical also. I mean, how can you, you know, because the bishops, their whole life is traveling around and visiting the various parishes. You know, you can't have a family like that. But in the West, it just became standard that there was this expectation that they would be unmarried. So that was a debate early on, and it just kind of never went away completely. It was, but, you know, for centuries it was like, okay, well, if the Roman Church wants to do things like that, that's fine, but all the rest of the churches didn't. Now, you can have, of course, monastic clergy. It's just not obligatory. You don't have to remain celibate to be a priest. And most are married. 1794, the first Orthodox missionaries come to North America, St. Herman of Alaska and the group that came with him to Alaska. That's the first. There are Orthodox people who've come, but that's the first actually missionary trip, group of missionaries that's sent to North America. And of course, that's in Alaska, which at that time is part of Russia. In 1821 is when the Greek War of Independence begins, and eventually Greece is frees itself from the Ottomans. And so then the church in Greece can function freely again. And I didn't really go into the way things were under the Ottomans, but basically what they did was they put all Christians within their empire under the Patriarch of Constantinople. They had what's called a millet system, which it's basically like ethnic nations within the larger nation. So Christians were an ethnic nation. So all Christians were basically put under the Patriarch of Constantinople, and then basically they had a scapegoat. If the Christians, if you know, they have a problem with the Christians, they would just kill the Patriarch. So it was, you know, it was like a new Patriarch every couple of years. And
so it wasn't a spiritual patriarch.
Well, this is the problem, you know. There was a rapid turnover. Certainly, some of them were godly men, and others might have been power hungry. You know, because they were given temporal authority over all the Christians in the empire. So they had a certain political authority. It was their way. It was the Turks' way of kind of organizing everything. You know, it's like you're in charge of those people, and they were second class citizens, the Christians. But they wanted it to be organized somehow. So this is how they did it. Anyway, so that created lots of problems, but. So now you have, during the 19th century was when a lot of these wars of independence were fought. The Greek nation became independent. Eventually you have like the Romanians and the Serbs, you know, they all become independent. And what that means is now you have these independent, now that they emerge out of the Ottoman Empire, there comes to be more of a nationalistic identity. You know, we are the Romanians, you know, where that didn't exist really before. But now there is, and so now there's a church that's connected to that as well. 1870 is when the first Vatican Council happened. Now the Pope is infallible, and the Immaculate Conception becomes a dogma. So that means it's a dogma, which means you have to believe those things to be saved. Papal infallibility and the Immaculate Conception, which later we'll talk about what the Immaculate Conception is. But for now, we don't believe in it. 1872, there's a council in Jerusalem which declares philetism or ethnophiletism a heresy. And this has to do with an incident where, again, you know, this is kind of coming out of the Ottoman, being part of the Ottoman Empire, and now you have these nationalistic groups, and there came to be a clash between the Bulgarians and the Greeks. I can't remember all the details, but basically, there's one group telling the other ones, like, well, you have your church over there, you know. That's the Bulgarian church, and we're the Greek church, you know, whatever it was. Yeah, but it's ethnic, you know, it's ethnic. And so this council says, that's not the way the church works. We're not divided into ethnic groups. There's one church for all people, remember? You know? So that's what that council does. It declares that a heresy, actually. It's a heresy to say we ought to be broken up into ethnic, separate ethnic groups in the church. 1891 is when St. Alexis Toth and thousands of uniates are accepted into the Orthodox Church under the Russian mission in the U.S. So this is when that happens, 1891.
Maybe I'm getting ahead of myself, but it was considered a heresy to toss us in the different ethnic groups. Don't we have that now?
Yeah, well, what we have now is the result of immigration, and we'll get into that a little bit. We'll get in just a little bit. In 1895, so again, right at the end of the 19th century, you have the formation of the Syrian Orthodox Benevolent Society. And here I'm starting to introduce kind of our history as a part of the Antiochian Church, which, again, this is having to do with immigration and ethnic groups. But what was happening? Russians were immigrating. Other Eastern Europeans were immigrating. Lots from the Carpathian Mountains. People from like Western Ukraine and Belarus and what was the Austro-Hungarian Empire. These people, many of them, they had very difficult lives, economically speaking. So America was very attractive. They came, they moved to places like Pennsylvania and worked in the coal mines. You know, there are towns in Pennsylvania where it's just like all Orthodox people, you know, people that, Slavic people and that kind of thing. So they came and they established communities. Well, as you can imagine, so you have these Slavic people, you have Greeks immigrating, you have Arabs immigrating. Well, they come and they're in this place where there's a foreign language they don't understand. They're, you know, the culture is different. They stick together, quite understandably. It's for survival. You know, it's a practical thing. So, of course, they form ethnic enclaves within America. It's a natural part of immigration. That's what everybody did, you know? Irish and Germans and, you know, they formed ethnic Italians in different places. Then, they immigrate, and then they kind of look around and say, we don't have a church. We need a church, you know? So this is what happened with the Syrians in New York. They formed the Syrian Orthodox Benevolent Society, and then they started lobbying to get a priest. You know, they said, we need a priest, we need a church. So this is what happened. So St. Raphael, the last one on the right there on our iconostasis, he came, and he's very interesting because he kind of transcended all the ethnic divisions because he loved Russia. He spent time in Russia. He actually came as part of the Russian church. But he was an Arab, and he spoke Arabic. So the Russian church provided him as a pastor to the Arabic-speaking Christians here. And at that time, all Orthodox Christians were under the Russians in America. This is what it was at the beginning of the 20th century. So the Russians provided an Arabic-speaking Orthodox priest for the ones who only understood Arabic, you know? So it was like a ministry to them. But the Antiochians, actually this community of the Syrians, by the end of St. Raphael's life, 10 years later, well, he came in around 1895, so 20 years after that was when he died, 1915, around then. They were using something like half English, which this was, for that time, that was really advanced. Like they were using, I think it was more than half English in their churches. So in the Orthodox churches that were under, that St. Raphael had established, he was really pushing, let's translate everything into English. Our children are going to be speaking English. They're not going to be speaking Arabic anymore. We need to do everything in English. So that was what was happening. And then, and certainly at that time, there were communities where, you know, they were like a melting pot, people from different places. But still, you have Greek enclaves, and basically that just continues until today. You know, that never, and one of the reasons why it was like the growth was stunted was that in 1917, the communist Bolshevik revolution happened. The Russian church was overseeing everything here. All of a sudden, many of them get pulled back at that time, and there's just chaos. And so it's like the missionary efforts of the Russian church are stunted. They're kind of cut off at that time. So that results in a certain amount of chaos over here amongst the Orthodox Christians. But let's talk about Russia for a moment. When the revolution happened, you know, not only Russia, but all the countries that became the USSR, all the whole kind of Eastern Bloc, came under eventually under communist authorities, and they were militantly anti-Christian, militantly. So they, I mean, right away in 1917, as soon as the revolution happened, they were carting off bishops, priests, monastics, right and left, taking them to the gulag. A lot of them just killed in a firing squad. Actually, the first priest martyr was Saint John Kochurov, who was an American, a Russian priest who came to America as a missionary. So he was here as a missionary. He was recalled to Russia, like right before the revolution happened, shortly before. He was there ministering to the people, and he was confronted. They were actually doing a procession or something outside, begging God for mercy, deliver them, and they came and confronted him, and they just shot him. They just killed him. So, anyway, obviously very quickly, things were very difficult there. There were periods of sort of relative easing of pressure on the church, but it was always difficult. And then there were periods where people were just being slaughtered like crazy, you know, millions of martyrs during the communist period, Soviet period. Anyway, so we talk about all the martyrs in the early church, but the 20th century was actually the one in which in the whole history of the church there have been the most martyrs. It was a very bloody century. So this, as I said, affected the Orthodox work here in the U.S., because the churches here had been very dependent on the mother churches, and of course Russia in particular. And because at that time there was sort of confusion, we went from having administrative unity to having administrative disunity. So we all still recognize each other as Orthodox, but now the Syrians have no choice but to sort of go back under the church in Antioch. And, you know, the Greeks are under Constantinople, and the Bulgarians and the Serbs, and, you know, so everybody's now just kind of looking to, as best they can, you know, for their support. They're looking to their various mother churches, so we lose that administrative unity. We even came to the point in 1936 where two Antiochian jurisdictions formed separate from each other. And that continued until 1975, when there was a reunification of the two Antiochian archdioceses. And this is just a long story about how this bishop came, and he was kind of a rogue, and you know, there was just confusion about what bishop they should follow. So now we come up to the end of the 20th century. Of course, 1989, there were revolutions in the former communist countries, Russia and Eastern Bloc countries, and within the next couple of years after that, at least, you know, all of them are freed, and things open up for the church again. And not only do they open up, but there's a renaissance in the Orthodox churches in those countries, and with massive numbers of people being baptized and so on. So that brings us up to basically the present. The current situation that we have here, of course, is we have multiple jurisdictions due to these historical reasons. We recognize one another as belonging to the Orthodox Church. We're in communion with each other. But we really ought to have administrative unity. And so we pray for that. That's definitely something to pray for.
Has there ever been some sort of call to
unify? Oh, yeah. Lots of them.
Hasn't happened yet?
Yeah. Just hasn't happened yet. So there have been strides forward, and then there have been setbacks. And sometimes, it's complicated because we're all connected to various mother churches, and a lot of the mothers don't want to let the children go. Because if we unite administratively, all of us, and we form our own American Orthodox Church, then they have to let us go. That's part of it, you know. So, but we think in terms of centuries, so God willing, eventually. But it would be nice to see it happen. I mean, obviously, it's much better to have a united witness, because people look at the Orthodox Church and they just don't get it. The jurisdictions, it's just like, they don't even, a lot of people, they just think Russian Orthodox and Greek Orthodox are two different things, you know. So, which is very unfortunate.
Makes that almost mandatory from an outsider perspective, like seeing the different names.
Of course. I mean, why would you think otherwise? It just sounds like you compare it to denominations. Well, you know, this is the Free Methodist and the United Methodist and the Greek Orthodox and the Russian Orthodox. They're different denominations. Of course, we don't understand it like that, but it's hard to explain to people. Anyway, I mentioned a little bit of the Antiochian history, just a little, because we belong to the Antiochian Archdiocese, and I won't go into all the other jurisdictions, but we'll just leave it at that. So, that's it for the church history overview. Any questions before we end for this evening? May God help us. God help us to receive everything that has been passed down to us by all of the saints. And I hope to go back and talk more about many of our heroes of the faith, because these were just like bullet points. But I'll try to share more stories of the heroes during all of those different eras, the ones who really sacrificed and gave their lives for Christ so that they could pass on the faith to the next generation. But we've received, you know, this incredible inheritance from our forefathers, foremothers in the faith, people who sacrificed so much. And so may God help us to be worthy of that, you know, to become good children of the church, faithful.
When we were catechumens, they were asking about when we should transmit it. So you shared something to the effect of, it's traditional for, you know, there are certain times, but also the priest is looking for a sort of readiness, a sort of, I'm not going to word it correctly, but certainly if we were like, what we want it now is a great indication of, maybe
yeah, you're not ready.
Yeah. So I'm saying that to say, as an American who loves my country, as a Texan, but recognizing that we are very much children in Orthodoxy. I understand, like, the Russian church here might not be, and the Syrian church might not be, but the Americans who are part or who have been baptized in and chrismated in, and so I can see the need for it to be centuries. I can understand, because we could quickly, right, turn it into the American Orthodox Church in a way
in the wrong way.
First, yes.
Yep.
So it's better. We really have to come under. I've also heard this thing of, like, it takes about 10 years to get an Orthodox mind.
Yeah.
You as a human being, as an
right.
individual. So, like, maybe it takes 200 years to get a, you know, an Orthodox country. I don't know. You know, in a... Anyway, we should have pushed.
To be really kind of frank, there's no place in the world where Orthodox Christianity has taken root and become mature where there haven't been martyrs. Yeah, but I mean, that's you have to have strong monasticism. And you have to have martyrdom. It's just, I mean, that's the blood of the martyrs is the seed of the church. Like, that's the church has to go through a period of suffering for it to be firmly established in a place. And I think that's part of our being immature here, is that we just, it hasn't been really hard to, you know. So God knows. But yeah, I think there's something providential about us having a hard time getting together, and God's just, He knows what he's doing with us, but there's also sin in that, because it really does have a lot to do with territorialism. Yeah, us not wanting to give up something. You know, that again, it's the right church, but we have problems. The people in it have problems.